It's 9 a.m. on Wednesday, April 10th, and this is Conference on World Affairs Panel 2101, looking ahead to the 2020 election. I'm Sam Fuqua. I'm on the Boulder Valley Board of Education, the school board, and I'm looking ahead to the 2019 election because I'm term limited and can give someone else a turn on the school board. I'd like to introduce all three of our panelists, and then after they're introduced, give them time to offer some opening remarks. I want to welcome Stephen Hayward. He is a senior resident scholar at the Institute of Governmental Studies at the University of California, Berkeley. You can read his writing at powerlineblog.com. That will also link you to his podcast, where the most recent episode asks the question, how progressive is progressivism? And about 6 years ago, he was the inaugural visiting scholar in conservative thought here at CU Boulder. So back for another visit. Welcome, Stephen. Michael Gerson is also with us, a senior advisor at One, a group engaged in the fight against extreme poverty and preventable diseases. He also served as a policy advisor and speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He writes a column for the Washington Post, which is syndicated in about 100 newspapers, including the Boulder Daily Camera, where yesterday I read the column. He ended it talking about the president's approach to immigration, saying, Trump's appeal to inner demons above better angels proved easier than many of us hoped, and that makes the political and moral damage harder to repair. Michael Gerson, welcome. Heather Hurlburt is our other panelist. She directs the New Models of Policy Change program at New America. That's a public policy think tank based in Washington, D.C. She served in the White House and the State Department under President Clinton, and you can hear her on the Dresbert podcast, and she also writes about foreign policy for New York Magazine, where one of her most recent columns on the website was titled, If NATO is Going to Survive Trump and Other Threats, It Must Adapt. Heather, welcome. Our format this morning, we'll begin with opening statements and then a few questions from me, followed by questions from the audience. In this session, we are going to utilize both the Conference on World Affairs app and a note card system to receive questions from the audience. To ask a question in the app, you simply select this session in the schedule and tap Q&A, then insert and send your question. It will appear on this laptop. You can also raise your hand to request a note card and a pencil from one of our producers. Please write legibly, and if you're a student or you're attending remotely, please note that in your question and make your questions brief and to the point. So, Stephen Hayward, our topic is looking ahead to the 2020 elections. Sometimes involves looking back, looking in the mirror. Where are you looking?
Oh, boy. I've thrown out my crystal ball. I'm put in the frame of mind of that old saying variously attributed to Yogi Berra or Sam Goldwyn that runs, never prophesy, especially about the future. I mean, having gotten everything wrong about the 2016 election, I just thought Trump was an impossibility from beginning to end. I woke up the next day and said, how'd that happen? And I'm still puzzling over some parts of it. I'm with Michael, who said yesterday, he says, I thought I knew how you run for president, and I don't anymore. So a lot of mysteries here. So I'll just try and I'm not going to make predictions. I mean, I have some hunches, but my guess is I'll be wrong. About the lay of the land a little bit, and a little bit of historical precedent. At this point in 1971, Nixon was in a bit of trouble. He had a mild recession, and the front runner for the Democratic Party was Ed Muskie. You know, he'd been Hubert Humphrey's well-regarded running mate in that very difficult, troublesome campaign of 1968, and there were some early polls in the middle of 1971 showing him, leading or neck and neck with Nixon in a hypothetical matchup. Of course, we all know what happened. Muskie literally melted down in the snow of New Hampshire. That's an unfair story, but that life is unfair, right? And the Democrats, partly because of the trauma of 68, had their McGovern moment. They wanted somebody much more ferocious and anti-war and anti-establishment and anti-the Democratic establishment in some ways. So they settled on McGovern, and Nixon cruised to the 49-state victory. Today, Michael, you mentioned this yesterday on the other panel, it looks like the Democrats may want to have another McGovern moment. They seem to want to have a platform or leading issues right now that amount to the longest political suicide note in history. We'll see about all that. And by the way, speaking of, Muskie, everybody in the Democratic Party is running, it seems like, except for what was Hillary's running mate? I just blanked on it.
Tim Kaine.
Tim Kaine. Mm-hmm. What, not even usually the running mate from the previous election ticket that lost is mentioned as a possible candidate. Tim Kaine seems to be in the witness protection program at the Democratic Party. And he's a former governor, and that's actually a point. There's only, I think governors make the best candidates. This is, I think, historically true. Good reasons for this. And there's only one governor. It's your former governor, John Hickenlooper,
who actually...
Jay Inslee. Ah, see, I forget. He's kind of easy to forget.
Scorecard. Can't tell the plans without a scorecard.
Right. Good. Yeah, I'd forgotten about him. Maybe there's someone else I've forgotten about. Aren't a lot of Democratic governors right now is part of the problem. The pool is small. But Hickenlooper, to me, seems like... Inslee's still pretty new in the governor's office. Hickenlooper seems to me... an interesting guy, plausible. We'll see how he goes. So second point is, any president with 3.7% unemployment and an economy that's growing decently, not great, but okay, and with a foreign scene that's okay, there's no acute crisis, there's no big war going on, that person ought to be cruising to an easy re-election. And the fact that it looks like an uphill struggle for Trump just shows all the baggage he has. This is not news. You sort of all know this. And right now, in fact, some of the political science models, I used to be very skeptical of them. The one by Ray Fair at Yale is the oldest one. And he's saying right now, Trump's going to... Conditions right now, the economy may change, probably will, I think. But that's another prognostication I don't want to do. Right now, if the election were run under current conditions, Ray Fair's model said Trump would win the two-party vote. Not necessarily Electoral College. By the way, Ray Fair's model in 2000, when all the polls showed George W. Bush narrowly ahead of Gore, Ray Fair was saying all along, no, Gore's going to win the popular vote. Might not win the Electoral College. So his model's been pretty good. And right now it's showing Trump winning the popular vote. I can actually foresee, because the world is so crazy, there'd almost be some rough justice in this. I could see Trump winning the two-party vote and losing the Electoral College this time.
It's possible.
And wouldn't that just be the most head-exploding thing ever? For everybody, right? So that could happen. But then the last thing I think to look for is sort of on the ideas. I mean, we can talk a bit, or Heather may want to, on sort of, you know, some of the leading ideas right now that Democrats have, you know, reparations, Medicare for all. I think you want to look and see where Trump and the Republicans go, because there may be a party reversal underway. So, you know, back in the 80s and the Reagan years that I've studied so closely, Democrats wanted industrial policy. They wanted domestic content legislation on manufacturing. They, you know, wanted some trade protection. Plant closing legislation. You had a lot of, like, you know, 6 months notice to close down a plant in the country. And, you know, the Reagan people and Republicans all fought against those. There's interferences with the free market, etc. Now, it's sort of Trumpian populist, Steve Bannon. I debated Tucker Carlson this issue a couple weeks ago. My first question, Tucker, was Ross Perot right about NAFTA? He says, absolutely he was right about NAFTA. So, you know, the point is this sort of protectionism, Trump's trade policy, it might work with China. I'm sort of willing to give him a shot at that, but it looks to me like it might settle into the old Republican policy of 100 years ago. Remember, the Republican Party of, you know, 100 years ago, 150 years ago, was a protectionist party. It was the Democrats who were free traders. They were also, isolation is a little too strong, but only a little. And, you know, it was only with Eisenhower, really, that the Republican Party finally signed on with the post-war consensus for liberal internationalism. Trump represents a departure from that. And you may see the Republican Party, the whole party, officially going that way in ways that are going to scramble heads. Because suddenly it's the Democratic Party saying, wait, we want to be careful about this trade business. It was the other way around in the 80s, and that's not that long ago. And so that's the thing to watch for. That may be the legacy of Trump, and it may be the axis this election turns on.
Thank you, Stephen Hayward. And Michael Gerson, what's on your mind?
Maybe I'll pick up where Steve left off on the Republican side. If I were a Trump supporter, which is a massive hypothetical that I can't even imagine.
You can do it, Michael. The
thing that Steve mentioned would be the thing that disturbs me most. We have an economy with under 4% unemployment, with significant wage growth. And his Gallup number for approval rating is 39%. Those things should not go together. And, you know, some of that is, much of this has to be related to Trump himself. A generic Republican would be doing much better, and Trump refuses fundamentally to be a generic Republican. And I think we're seeing the result. He's currently pursuing a base strategy, which might seem odd, given that he had consolidated the Republican base very well. But I think it's explained by his immediate political context of having Republicans support him in a variety of investigations where he needs the party united, and in avoiding a nomination battle, which I think he's effectively done both of those things. He's achieved those short-term purposes. I question his ability to do outreach even if he wanted to. He seldom acts outside his zone of comfort and never in a disciplined way. Some of this seems impulsive, perhaps compulsive, but it brings us more into the realm of psychology than political science. He's not often politically calculating. He's often impulsive in the way he does things. And if he needs an outreach strategy, I think it's going to be very hard for him. But he now benefits from negative polarization. You know, I would bet that 90-some percent of the American public, no matter what they say, has decided how they're going to vote in the next election, no matter who the two candidates are. And that's essentially because the judgment is our team or their team. And now Republicans have a deeply flawed president is our team. And I think that we're going to live with the repercussions of that, but it means that he is not going to fall apart. I think he's going to have strong support within his party and with people who lead towards his party. Now, he could clearly benefit from a Democratic opponent that goes too far to the left and wins by contrast. You know, last time he was a deeply unpopular politician who won by contrast. And that's what he's hoping again this time. Presents, I'll close with the most threatening prospect in American politics. This is the way I'd put it. The U.S. no longer has a center-right party at the national level. It's a nativist populist party. There is no center-right party, the kind of party that I was a part of at the national level. It is quite conceivable after this election, there will be no center-left party in America. Under those circumstances, you have a polarization machine. An election like Trump-Sanders is unworthy of a great country. This is a country that deserves better choices, but we may not end up with them. So.
Michael Gerson. And Heather Hurlburt.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be up here having this reasoned and thoughtful conversation, although my first thought was really, boy, who the heck wants to come out and talk about 2020 even earlier than necessary at 9 o'clock in the morning? So I really salute all of y'all for being here. And I want to pick up actually right where Mike left off, which is with this problem, this challenge of polarization and the kind of country and kind of system that we have. So those of you who heard me yesterday morning, the Democrats face this challenge of being, not a real political party at all, but a coalition of at least two political parties, a center-left political party and a feeling its oats more left political party. At the same time, and Mike, I would go a little further, and maybe it's not surprising, Trump is, at some point in the next few years, what Trump has made of the Republican base is going to be what a standard Republican is. I don't say that with any. I say that with no joy, no Schadenfreude whatsoever, because a two-party system needs two parties. But that's where we are. So the Democrats face this enormous, and everybody, the center-right folks without a home would really sort of like it if the Democrats would be a center-right party too. And at some point you are creating a strain that is too much for any structure to bear. So that's going to be one of the really interesting challenges we're watching now. At the same time, precisely because this is happening so early, in some ways this is the best of times to be a professional Democrat, because the field of ideas is so wide open. If we're sitting up here before the panel and Mike is talking to me about reparations, and I'm like, my party is actually talking about reparations. That's astonishing to me. My party is talking about Medicare for All. My party is talking about Green New Deal. Just the range, both in breadth and scope and ambitiousness and movement off of what had been the accepted boundaries of dialogue in American life, is so stunning. This is where I remind you that we are still 18 months away from the election. And I think a way of understanding what's happening now is that, very much as Trump has very intelligently moved the center of what is permissible, what is a right-wing position, what is a Republican position, he has moved that in a number of neck-snapping ways. But a parallel discussion on policy is happening on the left. What does it mean to be center-left? Center-left looks a lot more left than it did a few years ago. And I think we're going to, in 6-8 months, we're not still going to be discussing the full panoply of issues that we are right now, but we're going to have reset a new norm about what it means to be a center-left Democrat, what it means to be a left-left Democrat. So in some ways, we should all just kind of enjoy it. And those of us who do policy for a living should especially enjoy it, because we all love to sit up here and complain that elections aren't substantive. Right now, these elections are really quite substantive. It's not going to stay that way. So that would be my observation number one. Now, my observation number two is, I love all y'all, but you're not really normal to be here at 9 o'clock on a weekday morning. And normal people are not tuned into this at all. Normal people, as Mike said, know which tribe they belong to, and they'll tune back in later to find out what their tribe is doing in 2020. And that means that a lot of what's happening, that those of us, I may be the only one of us who's completely Twitter obsessed, but those of us who are politics obsessed think is incredibly important and is happening right now, people aren't even going to know about. So in some ways, we're having these parallel. So I'm having all these wonderful conversations about sort of gender bias in candidate coverage, but most people are just seeing the candidate coverage. They're not seeing the intense debate about the gender bias. The Pete Buttigieg boomlet is really interesting. I'm not sure how deep into society that's penetrating. You know, last month it was Beto. Next month, maybe it'll be Michael Bennett. Maybe it won't be Michael Bennett. I don't know. So I bring this up because I watched with great interest the Israeli elections, which were held yesterday. And whichever side you're on in those elections, you might reasonably have thought that people thought those were really important elections and that they would turn out to vote in large numbers. Record low turnout. So I want to say to you, that could happen here. Just because all of us think this is incredibly important does not mean that the American public, depending on the economic situation, I think among other things, and a general sense of fatigue and cynicism, thinks it's important. That at some point, this level of urgency that both Trump supporters and resistors feel, people can't sustain that over years and decades. So I worry a lot about assumptions based on outrage and momentum that wear out over time. And I guess the last point, well, two more points I want to make. One is, please remember the other things that are happening in 2020, down ballot races. Steve, you made a comment about the dearth of Democratic governors. There's a way to fix that, or to fix the dearth of anything. That's a nonpartisan comment. We do have the habit of over-fixating on the president, and there's a lot of other interesting races happening in 2020, but also in 2019. And finally, we do love, as a society, the personality and the horse race, and I wouldn't have thought that could get any worse, but I do think Trump makes it worse. And structural factors are going to be hugely important, particularly voter suppression. I don't really need to tell you that, but we kind of forget about it, and we tend to think that there is a candidate that can overcome the laws of gravity. And the best candidates are the ones, in my view, that look like they're overcoming the laws of gravity, but are actually very smartly working with the laws of gravity. So don't, you know, whoever you like, the laws of gravity still apply. And actually, I think Trump's win in 2016 is an excellent example of that. So I'll stop there, and we can get down to gossiping about candidates in the Q&A.
Heather Hilbert.
Yeah, please. Stephen Hilbert.
Can I just make one comment, Heather, on that turnout question? Is, you know, this last... I think we're going to have record turnout in 2020, in part because we had record turnout in this last midterm election. Actually, it's the highest ever. The actual numbers say the highest since 1970. It was a pretty polarized year because of Vietnam and everything, right? Except in 1970s, before you had the vote lowered to 18 from 21. So it's an apples and oranges comparison because, you know, those 18 to 21-year-olds, they just don't vote that much, and it's always depressed the gross percentage turnout number. So now we had numbers exceeded, and both sides turned out pretty big. I mean, the Democratic vote surged huge. The Trump-Republican vote held up pretty well, except Trump lost some more of those voters especially. That's why all of Orange County, California flipped every congressional seat, right? This is still a Republican area. It's eroded some, and they really hate Trump, right? It's true a lot of areas. And that was a vote of disliking Trump. Whether a really radical Democratic candidate will get them back, or some of them back, that's one of the imponderables right now that's a plausibility. But there's another side of this. That is the record low turnout in Israel. One of the things I've been watching the last few years is some municipal elections, places like Philadelphia, Los Angeles, New York. The last mayor's election in Los Angeles, the turnout was 13%. Now, it's not a two-party town. There's no voter suppression there. I think this is a longer conversation, maybe for another whole different kind of panel, but there's a collapse of sort of civic political culture at the urban level happening. I think it's creeping up the ladder. I could say a bit about why that was a problem in a certain way for Hillary Clinton, why she lost a lot of voters that Obama had, and how the press treated her unfairly in some ways. I'll say all that. And why that actually all worked for Trump, that's a long thesis. I just want to plant those out there as, you know, an interesting... So anyway, I think a big turnout, but this other problem is it has a deeper implications.
Just a quick question for Heather before we get too far along. You think a lot about foreign policy. You write a lot about that. Is that going to play any role at all in the 2020 election?
Yeah, thank you for asking me that. And I'd actually love to hear what both of you think about this as well. So one of the things that this president has done, building on things that were begun before him in the Republican Party, is to really collapse foreign and domestic affairs in the way he talks to his supporters. And this is actually, it's quite smart. Steve, before the panel, you referred to Trump's lizard brain. This is because we don't have...
That's an insult to lizards, by the way. But okay. Sorry, Andrew.
Hey, I just want it noted that I'm keeping the tone up here.
Yeah.
Because you don't have a separate neural pathway for fear caused by a North Korean nuclear weapon, fear caused by the prospect of losing your job, and fear caused by the prospect of driving home in a blizzard later, right? That's all fear. And this president has really weaponized, again, building on what came before him, he didn't invent this out of whole cloth, really weaponized a narrative where the physical bodies of people of color, the economic threat posed by foreign societies, and the cultural threat posed by you, your community changing around you, are all kind of weaponized into one potent thing that he personally is defending you from. And this gives, I don't think it's an accident that so many Never Trump Republicans are folks who come out of the foreign policy world, because it gives up, but it really is a huge challenge to how we think and talk about the world. So Democrats are really struggling, and I mean this in a good way, like we are doing battle with. The problem of how we tear down our own constructs about the world at home is a thing and the world abroad is a thing. And Stephen, you mentioned the sort of the interesting question of where are both parties going on industrial policy. How do we think about wrapping economics and security together? How do we talk to people about it? And if it isn't wrapped in a cocktail of racism, fear, and protectionism that turns out only to benefit your own cronies, what is the positive alternative to that? And coming up with a positive alternative while you're sort of under a rain of hammer blows has turned out to be pretty challenging. So yes, foreign affairs in the sense of foreignness and foreign threats is a never-ending sort of subtext of this race. That was a long answer to a short question, but I'll end with an anecdote. I advised a sitting senator on their 2018 reelect, and I was thrilled to be called by this person and walked in and sat down, and they said, well, I wanted to have you here to go over foreign policy before the debates, but there isn't really any foreign policy in this election. And I swallowed hard. And I said, okay, Senator, let's talk about immigration. How are you handling that? Let's talk about Israel policy. How are you handling that? Let's talk about trade. And so after about 45 minutes, it's really unusual to get 45 minutes of a sitting senator's time, by the way. So after this, I said, so, Senator, with all due respect, in my view, those are all foreign policy questions. And they invited me back for another session, and they won their race. So.
Michael Gerson, any comments there on foreign policy or foreign nests?
No, I actually agree with the collapse of foreign and domestic policy because the president's approach has been the fear of the other. That's been the organizing principle of Trump ideology. That's true of Chinese who are exploiting us. It's true of people who are Muslims who are attacking us. And it's true of Mexicans who are rapists and are invading us. I mean, this is the common theme of Trumpism. And one of the discouraging things, you know, as one of those foreign policy, you know, internationalists from the Republican Party, is how a number of these issues crumbled to the touch. It wasn't as though there was a big debate within the Republican Party about these things. Republicans, I thought, had an intellectual commitment to free trade because it's related to free markets. It's actually related to Republican ideology. I thought that, you know, Ronald Reagan praising refugees as one of his, you know, continual campaign themes, you know, this was an example of American exceptionalism used in Republican ideology in the past rather than a source of invasion and problem. But these, I fear what you predicted, which is on these topics, this could easily become a Republican orthodoxy with the re-election of the president. And a lot will depend on the re-election of this president or not when it comes to the solidification of various ideas as Republican ideology.
Let me ask an audience question. This person notes that all of us up here are white and asks, how do you do your best to create a conversation that is inclusive of other racial perspectives in this election? Who would like to start?
Well, I mean, I have the great luxury of getting to talk to a really diverse student body at Berkeley, which is huge fun. And so they're not uniform, but then the other experience. Okay, let me put back with a top line number. I still can't believe this, but Trump actually did better with Hispanic voters than Romney did. I thought he'd collapse to 5%, you know, lower than the black vote. He dead even. I mean, there's margin of error in the polls, but like, you know, 33-34%, something like that. How does that happen? So then a couple weeks ago, I'm flying back to Berkeley. I get an Uber at Oakland Airport, and here's my Hispanic driver. He's heavily tattooed, and he has a MAGA hat. And he goes on about how much he loves Trump. And I get curious, so are you Republican? No, that's sort of, you know, big business country club party. I've never ever felt an affinity for Republicans, but I love Trump. And he was saying, you know, I'm kind of with Trump on this migrant business. I think, you know, this, you know, he's, I got him to tell me, and, you know, it took half an hour to get to campus. I got him telling me sort of his life story. He came 30 years ago. He bought some property. His whole family worked like crazy. And he has the same view that, by the way, Cesar Chavez had in the 60s and 70s. Cesar Chavez wanted border protection for the old-fashioned labor market reasons that more people larger than the labor market can absorb is going to push down wages. And this guy said the same thing, right? So it's sort of not that simple, right? There's lots of variation. That's an anecdote, but I've heard others like it. You know, Trump, you know, of course he lost California by a huge landslide, but if you look at the county-by-county breakdown, it's all the coastal areas where people like me live. I look out at the ocean from my house, right? And he didn't do badly in the Central Valley, which is much more heavily Hispanic. Their turnout rates are still low in California. My political science department does a lot of work trying to understand that. So, I don't know. The thing about Trump is he does appeal to some Hispanics, because the Hispanic, I've done a lot of work over the years or analyzing how Texas Hispanics are different from California Hispanics. We tend to lump them all together under the big H label, and there's a lot more variation that has lots of dimensions to it. I'll stop there. I could go on, but about Trump's missing an opportunity. That's what I'm saying. But I mean, it's unfixable.
Yeah, my concern on those set of issues is that the Democratic Party is going through a reckoning with the issue of white privilege as an element of as opposing it as an element of Democratic ideology, and it's actually an important set of issues. You know, racism to some extent is not just a personal feeling; it's rigged institutions over a long period of time that produce generational inequities and. And there's a discussion on how that should be approached, and reparations are coming in that context, and this is going to be a major theme of the Democratic debate. And Democrats, by all the evidence with Trump, are going to go into a buzzsaw on this set of issues. I think the president could really set back this discussion in a lot of ways by caricaturing it easily. Some of the New York Times this morning had a poll that says on the reparations issues that 81% of whites oppose reparations. It is a massive, uniform issue among most Americans. And so I'm afraid we're going to have a really bad, inadequate debate on an important set of issues, and that President Trump was going to come out on top.
Mike, I first want to say that I really appreciate you bringing up structural racism so I didn't have to. Thank you. Second, discussions of issues you have in presidential campaigns are always bad and inadequate. So, yes, that's not just a probability, it's a certainty. Third, this is nonetheless an amazing cultural moment that it's not even so much that I didn't think I'd live to see it as I just never imagined the possibility of seeing it. Right? And I would guess that would be true. I mean, the idea that we would, it's not that I thought, oh, someday we'll talk about reparations, but I'll be, you know, retired. I just never occurred to me that I would sit on a stage and we would have that conversation. So in answer to the questioner, my view, which I would guess is not shared by all of us, is that there's a really important discipline of looking around at your space and saying, how can I make space for others to contribute equally? And sometimes, like at this particular moment on this particular panel, there's not really much I can physically do, but I can think about whose perspective do I need to invoke up here. Sometimes it is about saying, yeah, you know what, I don't need to do this panel, someone else can do this panel. Sometimes it's about saying, yeah, you know what, I don't actually need to run for president right now. Sometimes it's about saying, yeah, I don't need to be the one who does that interview. Or it's about saying, you know what, sometimes I can just shut up and let the people who are affected put their perspectives to the fore. And I think for all of us who are endlessly trained that it's important to put our perspectives to the fore. Maybe for those of us who were women and who were taught remedially, you have to keep pushing all the time to get your voice in there, and then now actually know you're supposed to step back. That's really confusing. But this is the moment we live in, and I both agree with what Mike said about how awful and unpleasant and damaging this is in a 2020 context, but as a human, this is what I can do to recognize the equal shared humanity of everybody else around me in all aspects of my daily life, and at some point, I have to behave the way I believe is moral and correct, and I can't fix or stop the president. So I'm, although it presents challenges for me, thrilled, and it's, as I say, a really exciting moment to watch what politics looks like when everybody who is in the United States actually gets to play.
And somewhat related to that comment, another audience question, do you feel like the youth vote will be more pronounced in the 2020 election? Anybody can start.
I'll just be cynical and say no, and then, Stephen, you can tell me why I'm wrong.
I don't know you're wrong. I have no idea. Obama was brilliant at turning out the youth vote, but he was an inspirational figure. But also, you may know this, I mean, his campaign was just absolutely brilliant at finding all those youth voters and turning them out. Okay, he was the first campaign in 2008 to really use social media with such great effect to find people. Whether that can be done again, I don't know. Again, it's candidate quality, right? If hard to see a lot of young people getting excited about Joe Biden, maybe about Bernie. He has that sort of authenticity to him that you like him, right? Biden is harder to see that. I could see Kamala Harris being a very attractive candidate for young voters, maybe. I think she's in my final four right now, if you want predictions, but for what they're worth. So I don't know. That's every year this comes around, especially for Democrats. Are the youth vote going to turn out? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. In 1972, Democrats thought first year of the 18-year-old vote, the polls are wrong, all these young voters, they're going to surge out and prove the pollsters wrong. Didn't happen.
I'll just briefly note that I had a son who was 18 years old in the 2016 election. It was his first election for President of the United States. And I think it's going to take a decade or more to even have him consider Republican candidates again. I think that this is a common experience of young people. You have seen a collapse of the Republican Party among younger voters. Now, I think, Republicans benefit by the fact that they don't vote. That's generally true as a principle, but I think that we're going to have generational effects from the ideological debates we're having right now. I think there's been a real alienation of younger voters who are more accustomed to multiculturalism, who are less hostile to foreigners. That I think that Republicans are going to suffer with this for a long time. I mean, they are solidifying, diminishing coalitions in American life, whether it's white voters or white working class voters. These Republicans are really solidifying groups that are not growing. And Democrats are doing well among young people and minority voters, groups that are increasing as a percentage of the electorate. And so that, over time, that doesn't mean that Trump is going to be defeated, but it means over time it gets harder and harder and harder for Republicans to win national elections.
Well, I'll ask each of you to do a little prognosticating before we get back to audience questions. How about, Stephen, we can start with you. You talked about your final four or on the Democratic side, or who's your Ed Muskie this time around. You can start.
What do I think? It's the four B's in the H. Biden, Beto. He's raised $17 million bucks really fast, and he showed this great energy in that Texas race, and he's sort of a celebrity. We'll see if that takes. Then who's my third? Bernie. And then Kamala Harris. Now, I'm sort of intrigued by Buttigieg. So step back a minute. One of the things that the last election flipped around also was the traditional rules of the two-party, which was Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love. Right? The Democrats always want to fall in love with a candidate. It was McGovern and Clinton and Obama, of course. And Republicans, it's the next guy in line. It's Bob Dole in 96, and it's just Reagan in 80. And right, it's the person whose turn it is. This last election, it should have been Jeb Bush, maybe, or one of the other, Scott Walker, raised a lot of money and looked like a plausible guy and utterly collapsed before he got the starting line. And instead, it was the the Republicans who fell in love with this Trump guy. And it was the Democrats who fell in line behind the establishment person in Hillary, even though you saw all that enthusiasm for Bernie. I kind of wanted, in retrospect, you know, you said it would be terrible if it was Bernie and Trump. I thought if it was Bernie and Trump, by the way, you know, the surveys show that Trump got maybe as much as 30% of the people who voted for Bernie in the primaries. Again, this doesn't fit an ideological framework, right? What if they'd run against each other? You would have had a guy who didn't really belong to the Republican Party until recently against a guy who didn't belong to the Democratic Party until recently, right? This is talking about the hijacking of the two parties by outsiders and how scrambled things are. Now, I'm straying from the question, but I think I'd like to go back to smoke-filled rooms and in the days of legal weed. Just think how great they'd be. But, you know, we threw that away 50 years ago, and I think there's been a long decay because I think we need the old party establishments re-empowered so they can say, no, you can't have the nomination, Trump or Bernie. And they're going to be, you're going to do it. You'd be a good candidate. Here's why. And, you know, we throw that away. Both parties did, and for popular primaries and all the rest, and it's just spun out of control, and here we are.
Heather?
Sorry, it's an extra rant. Yeah.
Michael?
I won't add too much to that list, but I'll say, I mean, you were talking about how us on the center-right want the Democratic Party to be the center-right as well. And in that spirit, I would throw Mitch Landrieu out there, who doesn't seem to be running, but should. And the reason is, not because he is a moderate who can speak to religious voters and knows how to address different groups than Democrats normally address. And that, by the way, is in the great tradition of Democratic politics, coming from Bill Clinton coming from Arkansas, and Al Gore coming from Tennessee, and Jimmy Carter coming from Georgia. But it's because he is actually engaged in the most serious and significant racial dialogue in speeches that he's made of any candidate that I've seen. And it's he dealt with the issue of the monuments in New Orleans in, I think, a very forthright and effective fashion. He's shown the kind of leadership skills that could build, I think, unusual coalitions without sacrifice of principle. But I don't think the Democratic Party's looking towards people like that at all. So.
Yeah, one of the things that really worries me, actually, again, looking cross-nationally for comparisons, I find many of the Democratic candidates and some of the people who've talked about challenging Trump in the Republican primary to be quite admirable. So I don't feel like we have a quality problem. But if you look at, again, if you look at the UK, if you look at Israel, if some of the Western European societies, you're really having trouble coming up with candidates that can match the environment into which they're thrust. And I wonder a lot about the future. I think I agree with you about Mitch Landrieu. I don't think he has the fire in the belly to run, which may be one of the reasons he's so good at his current job. And then I think so. Landrieu, Sherrod Brown, Mike Bloomberg. Who else has already bowed out? Mayor of L.A. Eric Garcetti, and those are all guys that I think are, and it's interesting that they're all guys, that are really interesting. So that I sort of point to with some alarm about maybe good people that should have run and didn't. I think Biden's going to be the Jeb Bush of 2020. I really do. I think he'll come in. I think he'll stay in a long time. I think he's a really decent man who's never been a particularly good presidential candidate. And I don't see evidence that of that changing this time around. I think Bernie will go the distance because he's got the organization to go the distance. I think Harris will go the distance. She looks to me, we were saying earlier, that she looks to me to have had the best planned and structured launch, and she's kind of just moving steadily through this early period. The B-boys, we'll have to see how much staying power they have.
A question about immigration, phrased this way. Trump will weaponize immigration for 2020. What can or should the Democrat do to counter?
That's a question for Heather, I think.
I got asked this question. Someone's following me around and asked that question yesterday. Okay. That's what I was going to say. I'm going to let Mike start with that one.
Yeah, right. If I were advising a Democratic candidate, you know, there are people in the Republican coalition you can try to peel off on immigration. And they're generally people who are economic conservatives because there's a really good economic arguments and ideological arguments for a serious immigration policy. But, I think we've overridden a lot of those rational choices in American politics. I think it's going to be as bad as it's ever been. And more than that, I think if the president is reelected, that he'll feel even more free to pursue a disturbingly nativist immigration policy. And we could really careem off into some horrible directions from where we are now. So I may be raising the stakes on that issue and just saying, we're going to be a different country after this. If it continues to go in this direction and decay in this way, we're not going to be the country that we were 20 years ago in a disturbing way. And someone needs to bring that message, I think, in a compelling way.
Yeah, I want to jump in on that. It's very interesting to me on the substance of how do you manage immigration? How do you think about how you structure, who you let in, and how you deal with the fact that we have a number of Central American countries in free fall where people are living in truly horrific conditions and think that death and detainment camps en route are better than staying where they are. So that's a really, really serious policy conversation. And I think it's super interesting that Julian Castro, who we didn't mention among the candidates, really interesting guy, although I'm not sure he can ever get up to the first tier for a number of structural reasons. But Castro put out his own comprehensive immigration reform plan the other day, and it got no attention. Because in an election campaign, you have to make really hard choices around immigration when you're seriously talking about how many people do we let in, what kinds of people, what's our vision for how that works. Nobody wants to talk about that. Democrats will get no airtime and traction if they do try to talk about it. And so instead you will have what Mike is talking about on the one hand versus Democrats saying we want to treat everybody humanely, we want to be a country that is fundamentally humane, and that's right and true as far as it goes, but in a highly polarized society, as you say, the people who've already decided that those folks with their sick kids at the border and the women escaping gang rape are some kind of existential threat to us, a political campaign is not the tool to come back from that, so we're not going to.
You know, it just occurred to me now that maybe the clever thing to do, now take it for what it's worth, I'm not on Heather's team, but the clever thing to do might be to say that Trump has proven himself incompetent on this issue. And it has made the problem worse.
Yeah.
I think it's actually true of the numbers. I mean, I think the numbers that are reported is the Border Patrol apprehended 100,000 people last month. Those are big numbers.
Right, yeah.
And so why did that happen? Well, this is a classic case study for someone like me of the unintended consequences and perverse results. I'm not sure if this is the right line to take. I'd want to know more, and it's hard to know. But why have the numbers surged lately? I mean, one possible explanation is, especially when you think about, border crossings and, dropped way off after Trump's first elected because people thought, oh my goodness, it's the wall's going up or whatever. Now they've come way back up and, maybe higher than ever. So maybe some people are like, let's do this while we can before the wall goes up. Well, that's not what Trump wanted or people wanted. And that could be an interesting line is, you've made this problem worse, Mr. Trump, because you're incompetent about it. Put some adults back in charge. Something like that, I think, might peel off that Hispanic taxi driver who says he wants immigration control. I don't know.
If I may, that was actually used very successfully at a state and local level in 2018. And you have a lot of former Obama DHS officials who are very eager to make exactly that line of argument and will very happily fly around the country and appear at campaign rallies to make that line of argument. The interesting thing is it's not it's not sexy, and so it's hard to make it play at the national presidential level. It works great at a representative and state level. It's harder to deploy in a national context. I'm trying to think whether it was NPR or The Times, but there's some evidence actually to support your hypothesis about what's happening. One thing is the many of the variations in migration are seasonal and have nothing to do with who is in the White House, that there are times of the year where there are spikes, and we are now in a time where there's always a spike, although this is a bigger spike. The winter, right after Trump is elected, there's always a fall-off. There was a fall-off. He could take credit for it. But I read somewhere in the last week or two, and I apologize for not remembering where, of some outfit that had gone down and done interviews, and people said, you know, at some point Trump is going to succeed in building an actual wall, and then we won't be able to get in, so we had better get in now, which means that all the propaganda about terrible treatment and separation of parents and children is not deterring people. And so therefore, in addition to having been immoral on its face, it's immoral in that it's not even achieving the desired objective.
Another question from the audience. What effect will third parties and or independent candidates like Schultz have on the 2020 election, and what effect will the ongoing two-party polarization have on the potential for a centrist third party to fill the void in the middle in 2020 and beyond?
Well, I don't know. So I had some fun with this the other day. Schultz tweeted out, the only criteria for appointing someone to the Supreme Court is that he or she is a defender of the Constitution, to which I tweeted out, turns out Schultz is a closet Republican. And this is part of the problem, right, is I don't know if he's going to run or not, and so far he hasn't been very impressive in the ordinary sense of just being a very compelling figure, and he's got all this money to spend, and I don't see him catching on, but who knows? Bloomberg is the more interesting figure. I mean, he's thought about this and thought about it, but both Bloomberg and Schultz have said, we can't make it in today's Democratic Party. I think Bloomberg is a very, very strong candidate. I think he'd wipe the floor with Trump. Doesn't think he'd get the nomination. I'm told he looked really hard at running third party last time, and, you know, all the ballot access problems and all the rest of that, and said that's not going to work. It's just going to divide the vote and, you know, elect Trump. And so he's not going to do it for the same reason. He's just going to divide the vote and guarantee that Trump is reelected. And so I think it's too bad. There's another figure I think would be a strong character or candidate.
Yeah. My New America colleague Lee Drutman has done a wonderful graph based on 2016 exit polling, which you can find if you Google Drutman quadrants. And what he did was plot people on two axes, liberal conservative on social issues and liberal conservative on economic issues. And the majority of voters fall in either liberal on both or conservative on both. And that, to some extent, is how we think of the two parties, although it's obviously rather inexact these days. And Schultz's whole bet, and the bet that frequently comes up in sort of elite policy circles, is that there are all of these supposedly unserved voters who are liberal on social issues and conservative on economic issues, and poor them, they're the really disenfranchised one who need the moderate third party. But actually, if you look at his graph, there are very, very few people in that quadrant, so few that they might all have their own column with a major media outlet. And the really underserved quadrant is the liberal on economic issues and conservative on social issues, which is kind of the old white Democrat working class vote. But it's very hard to imagine sort of where the third party champion, I mean, Trump is the third party champion of that until he decided to, you know, I don't know, just be himself. Then the other finding of Lee's that I don't know how to point you to, but if you Google his name, you'll find it eventually, is the enthusiasm for a third party in America is really an enthusiasm for about six different third parties that kind of align perfectly along the fault lines between the two existing parties. And it's very, very difficult to find a critical mass of Americans who could come together and make enough of a coalition to make a third party competitive. And this is why people like Mike Bloomberg, who actually put the time and thought into it, decide not to do it. whether she'll... I have kind of been waiting to see the kind of competence out of the Schultz campaign that indicate to me they could be an effective spoiler and I should worry about them. Because I do think a third-party candidate could be an effective spoiler in the upper Midwest in particular. I haven't yet seen it, but it's still early.
Yeah, I would just add, you know, the person who most closely resembles that liberal economics and social conservatism would be someone like Kasich running as a third-party candidate.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you were to measure people's moral self-confidence as a measure of running for a president, I think that Kasich would, would work. He is a man that's confident in his own morality. And that's what it takes to some extent to be an effective third-party candidate. But I think the only usefulness of that would not be necessarily to shift the election. It would be to have someone on the stage in a debate that represents more center-right republicanism and holds up that form of ideology in the as a placeholder in the national debate. And that might be useful. It could be instructive. There are a lot of reasons to run for president, and that might be a useful one.
Another question from the audience. What will it take to bring compromise and civility back to the political scene? And I know it's so easy for all of us to be cynical about that, but it's an important question. Who would like to take that?
Politicians have to think they gain more from compromise and civility than from conflict. And, I mean, that sounds really obvious. But in an environment where 40% of your voters are so easily weaponized for primary challenges and where it looks like extremism will get you access to the levers of power, it's very hard for me to see what the near-term incentive is.
Yeah, this is our biggest problem. On Friday, I'm back at Berkeley for this, you know, very academic-y conference where I'm going to do a game theory analysis of why the two parties no longer cooperate in Congress the way they used to within, you know, even the last 15, 20 years. And, you know, if you know the classic prisoner's dilemma part of game theory, there are short-term rewards for defecting and not cooperating, even though your long-term interest is in cooperating. I've never thought it necessarily applied, but it really does now. So this is going back now. You started seeing this back in the Clinton years when Republicans decided they would oppose Hillary Care after being open to compromise about it for a while. That's partly the Clintons' fault. They didn't want to compromise because Bob Dole was ready to cut a deal. The Clintons said, no, our way or the highway. That was their catastrophic mistake. But then what Republicans learned from that election was intransigent opposition will be rewarded. And we've seen that repeated now with both parties ever since then. And so I'll give you one quick example. The tax bill that just passed, and it's got the elimination or the severe limitation of the state and local tax deduction. That is a dagger at the heart of California, Illinois, New York, Connecticut, you know, high tax blue states, right? And they know it. Andrew Cuomo, the governor's, complained about it quite bitterly. And now the interesting thing is, and it passed on a partisan vote. By the way, when the Democrats said, the Senate in particular, that we're not going to cooperate, we're against tax reform, we're all voting no, I happen to know this, you know, from people in the room. Mitch McConnell said, this is great, because it means we can pass the tax bill we want. So contrast the 86 Tax Reform Act. That's the comparison. That's an interesting story. But that was a bipartisan bill. The Democrats said to Reagan, this is after the election, when they realized that Mondale saying to raise taxes was a loser, said, okay, we're going for tax reform. We're for that. And Reagan's proposal was eliminate the state and local tax deduction. The Democrats said, look, we want them to make a deal, but that's a deal breaker. We can't have that. And it was dropped immediately. And so you got a tax reform bill, and you know, 30 years till we have another one. And look, here's the point. If 10 Democrats in the Senate had said, or five, maybe even just five, saying, we'll work with you on a tax bill, but that has to go. That's just, you know, that's just the inequities there, and it's, you know, hurts our states and so forth. They could have knocked the thing out. And so now what the problem is, when you pass things on a party line vote, whether it's Obamacare, whether it's you know, other things you can point to on either side, the Republican tax bill, is we're now passing things in a parliamentary fashion, and that's a political disaster. And but it works in the short term. Right? And so this is a problem. I don't know how we're going to break out of that cycle. It may take a crisis of some kind that's surely coming at some point with our entitlements and the national debt, which Republicans don't seem to care about anymore, sadly. But that's a ways off, and who knows what that's going to be like, but it's going to be bad.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can be too much more upbeat.
I'm the happy guy, right?
Exactly. I guess my question is a broader cultural question. We are moving from polarization in America towards dehumanization of our opponents. And that is a moral movement. And the question is, do people go up to this abyss and look into it about the kind of politics we become and say, well, we could actually have the kind of politics in 1968 once again in American life? Is that a sobering prospect for people? You know, I carried this case that it should be to the Texas Baptists last week. This is the, you know, meeting of Baptist pastors who have been uniformly, you know, pro-Trump. And making the case that dehumanization, when you get to that point, from a Christian perspective, is not just a political failure, it's heresy. It's a violation of Christian anthropology. This was, by the way, one of the great evangelical contributions to American history in the 19th century, was a support of abolitionism and a belief in, you know, human rights and dignity. That's the argument that I'm making, particularly to value-oriented elements of the Republican coalition. You should recoil from this. You feel like this is over the boundaries. And that hasn't happened yet, but I can't give up hope that it might.
I want to jump in and say how much I appreciate Mike doing that work, because it's not work that I can do anymore in America, which is one of the more terrifying things of the moment. And the other point I want to make relevant to the topic of this panel is that elections are not going to be how we fix this problem. And political parties are not going to be how we fix this problem. It's a broader cultural phenomena. And what we see, you can stick around for the political violence panel that's next here if you want more on this, but political parties are driven by the cultural phenomena that cause the problem, and they can be part of movements that make choices once a movement to heal is underway, that we see, but we see from other cases around the world, the fix doesn't start from politics, because politics is inherently conflict over resources and power.
Well, I have three questions I'll group together. What, if anything, is being done to mitigate Russian involvement in the 2020 election? How will the Mueller report affect the election? And then, do we need to be concerned about foreign influence in the 2020 election? Heather, could you start there?
Yeah, you should be really concerned. Not so much that someone is sitting somewhere thinking, how can we make sure Trump is reelected? Because the Russians are pretty frustrated with Trump, too, if that's any consolation. But the ability to use our own flaws against us and help further diminish our trust in our system and accelerate this spiral of dehumanization toward violence that Mike was talking about. The answers to that lie mostly in strengthening our own system internally, and only, I think, secondarily in putting pressure on Russia, and also, by the way, China, which plays this game, not so much with us, but in Asia. Not that pushing back on Russia isn't important, but the real big fix at home. The Mueller report, we are where we are. No, it's not going to matter that much, because everyone already knows what they think about it for all the same reasons that were said by my colleagues earlier in the panel.
Either of you, anything to add on that one?
I'm not sure that's true about the Mueller report. We'll see.
Okay.
This is a case where the president's interpretation, the current interpretation, is the best he's ever going to have, given the dynamics of how this report is let out. And one of the findings, without all the evidence supporting it, is that there could be a good case that the president obstructed justice. It was like, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, according to the best summary of the outcome that came from the attorney general. So, I think we're going to see in a 400-page report a great deal of corruption. And I don't know how Americans respond to the issue of political corruption anymore. Does it matter? But I think that it's going to be a stronger case in a couple of weeks than we have now.
I got nothing.
Okay. It's okay to have nothing sometimes. And our time is running short, but an audience member asks, what issue keeps you up at night? Stephen Hayward.
In a sort of vague and general way, I have a few differences with Michael, but I share emphatically his general unease of how we're spiraling out of control in our divisions in the country. As a general matter, this is very bad. Some particular things. I grew up in the duck and cover days, right, in grade school, and there are various versions of that that can come back. Right. I mean, I do read some of this techie stuff. This is a very particular thing, but, if there really was a big EMP, electromagnetic pulse blast, we're back in the 18th century, and the catastrophe of that would just be, it is a nightmare scenario. And the North Koreans could do that, the Iranians could do that at some point, if they want to, if they're suicidal enough. But, a contagion of some kind, some bug that that spreads around the world that we can't figure out, or one that's designed by a terrorist. I think all these things are plausible things. We got to take a historical perspective of things, and things like, my podcast of progressivism is, you go back to before World War I, and everybody's optimistic. 20th century is going to be great. It's going to be all this Teddy Roosevelt, moral progress and material progress. And 1913, Norman Angell publishes a book called The Grand Illusion about how it's impossible now for there to be a war in Europe because everyone will go bankrupt. Well, we had one and we went bankrupt, or Europe did. And, who could have imagined what came after that, right? And so, lots of things wrong always, but in some respects, the last 30, 40 years have been pretty good. I think Steven Pinker's right about this. If you just do the data on violence, it's actually going down overall. War's actually been going down, but you think that, I just look at the 20th century and say, I'm not sure it'll happen, but I am not at all confident that we couldn't do worse. I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm usually the happy, optimistic guy, but...
Sweet dreams, buddy.
Yeah.
Okay. Michael?
I guess I would share the foreign policy concern, and not because we have a president who is an isolationist, but because we have a president who's a fool. And there's a difference. There's a difference there. I think you could be a principled isolationist. This is a man who raises the stakes of global conflicts by announcing there's a crisis, and then claims to have solved something that never existed in the first place as a method of foreign policy. And that, to me, is just an extraordinary thing for a great power to be controlled by someone who is that incompetent in their conduct of American foreign policy. Now, we haven't seen the worst consequences of that, but I'm just afraid we could.
Yeah, so just I will make a little side note, Stephen, because we've been so harmonious on this panel. But Stephen Pinker's data on violence against women is appallingly bad and drawn from appallingly bad sources. So regrettably, it's worth taking his conclusions on that matter with a grain of salt. Michael has made the foreign policy point as well as I possibly could have. So I'm just going to say I worry enormously about hate spiraling into violence. And I worry about that in a general sense for the future of the country that I love, and I worry about it in a very specific sense for myself and my family and the people I love. So that's what keeps me, not so much keeps me up, I'm awake in the night because I'm middle-aged.
yes, right. Yep.
But it's what gets me up in the morning to do this work is that particular fear.
All right, well.